Case number 12-5149, Becky Roberts, appellant versus United States of America et al. Mr. Wells for the appellant, Mr. Shawaby for the appellees.
Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is John Wells. I'm appearing on behalf of the petitioner, the appellant in this matter, Becky Roberts. Your Honors, throughout our history, the courts have given high deference to members of the military and to the military itself in making military decisions, and certainly in some respects this is true. We do not need non-military people getting involved in tactical or strategic decisions, where to deploy the ships, when to fire missiles or guns. But when we're looking at the administrative aspect of it, sometimes I believe we give too much deference. And if you read the standard of deference that my good friend Mr. Shobai has put in his brief, it would almost take a war crime to actually violate that standard. We believe that the standard is somewhat more relaxed for administrative. The district court in the Adair case mentioned in the brief has certainly adopted that for administrative matters. We think that's important because the Administrative Procedures Act, although it exempted some portions of the military, such as court-martials and other tribunals, from the Administrative Procedures Act, did not exempt just routine administrative matters. Now, in the particular case we have at bar, I think this is very important because we have a superior naval officer who, on two occasions, ran afoul of the fitness and evaluation reporting system. The first one was just basically an error. And if you look at Captain Bence's letters, which he wrote to the board, and I believe these are on page 51 to 52, he basically said, I made a mistake. I was not aware of the nuances of a new fitness report system, and I did something which hurt her, and I did not mean to hurt her. One would have thought, at that situation, the Board for Correction of Naval Records, using their equitable powers under 10 U.S.C. 1552, would have said, fine. A mistake, no harm, no foul. Let's set that fitness report aside and have her looked at again. Was she harmed by that mistake, Captain Spence? Certainly she was.
Let me just be clear. His letters, as I read them, and correct me if I'm wrong, said his mistake went to his not understanding his or the unintended consequences of what he did.
That's correct.
Not that he was reevaluating her. Is that correct?
Well, I think technically you are correct. He said my unfamiliarity with the long-term impact, subtle influence of the new fitness report system should not be used to negatively impact Lieutenant Commander Roberts' promotability. But if you look at the previous two pages in the appendix, Captain Kirkpatrick's review, and that would be at appendix 49 and 50, she indicated, and her understanding was apparently somewhat better, that this would have a definite detrimental effect. Now, Captain Bence later on wrote two separate boards saying that Commander Roberts should be selected. So although he didn't come out specifically and say, I hurt her, I think certainly the implication was there. And if you look at what Captain Kirkpatrick said, certainly it's more than implication. She came out and said, this isn't going to help.
He didn't say that he would have given her a different rating.
He did not specifically state that. No, sir, Judge Ginsburg, he did not.
So that would seem to be a problem.
I'm sorry?
It would seem to be a problem, a significant problem for your argument.
Well,
he didn't understand some of the consequences, but he didn't say he would have rated her differently.
Well, again, I think you have to read this in line and perhaps in paramateria with Captain Kirkpatrick's statement, where she basically indicated that he just didn't recognize, he wanted to recognize another officer's improvement. And that, therein comes the problem.
He had a tie on their trait ratings, correct?
They were tied on trait ratings, yes, sir.
To the second decimal point.
Yes, sir, I believe that's true.
So he had to break the tie.
He did.
And he decided to break it in favor of somebody who was improving rather than someone who had been a consistent performer.
That is what he said.
And you think he doesn't have the discretion to make that kind of a tie-breaking decision?
Well, first off, I don't think he has the discretion because of the Office of Naval Intelligence instruction. Now, we can...
Well, how is he supposed to break the tie based on that instruction?
Well, he could have done it in several ways. First of all, what he should have done, as somebody who has written a number of fitness reports, is gone back and reevaluate and compare the two on each trade average and say, Commander Roberts, the other gentleman, Commander Roberts,
well,
the other gentleman.
We don't know that he didn't do that. This is his final evaluation.
That is correct.
The numbers that he entered were his final numbers for the two, and they were a tie.
But in his counseling of Commander Roberts with Captain Kirkpatrick present, he didn't indicate that he'd done that. What he did indicate was that he was effectively giving somebody an attaboy, and when I say that, I don't mean that. I mean that one to be gender neutral, to reward them for their sustained improvement.
Right, that's one way of breaking the tie. I don't understand why that's not a permissible way of breaking the tie.
Well, Your Honor, I would respectfully disagree with you and say that would be arbitrary because, again,
is there a non-arbitrary way of breaking the tie to the second decimal point?
Well, again,
assuming the calculation has been done right.
That's why I say you have to go back and compare
the two on
each trade.
Calculation.
I'm sorry?
We have to assume his calculation is what he regarded as correct.
We have to assume that, yes. But we still don't know if, and unfortunately, in writing these fitness reports, so much of it comes down to basic discretion and sending messages, not just to the selection boards, but to the individual. And I understand where he's coming from in saying, I wanted to give this other gentleman an attaboy. I understand that. The problem is he did not understand, and he admits this, the long-term impact of what he did. I don't think there's any...
I don't see how that can possibly serve to undo his decision. You may have misapprehended the likely possible consequences, but that doesn't affect the validity of the decision that he made.
Well, now we have to go back and take a look again at the Office of Naval Intelligence instruction. And basically, it tells him he has to make a decision. And, I know Mr. Shobai made a lot of words, a lot of discussion on the term guidance. I can tell you as a military officer, when I was on active duty, if I told somebody to come around, I'm going to give them some guidance, there was no question that was mandatory. In fact, I quoted in the reply brief a couple of military court decisions where somebody was prosecuted and convicted of disobeying such guidance. Guidance in the military is mandatory.
The purpose of the counseling is, I believe, to help the candidate, the officer, improve her performance.
Purpose of counseling is to improve the performance. That's true.
There was no decline in Commander Roberts' performance.
There was not. And the issue...
What would have been accomplished by counseling?
Well, I think we're all... I'm sorry, perhaps I was off on a different tangent than you. Counseling also has the idea of laying out a plan of action for the individual to make them aware of their strong points as well as their weak points. When I use the term guidance in regards to the Office of Naval Intelligence instruction, I was not talking about the counseling provisions. I was talking about guidance on how to prepare the fitness report. And there, as I say, that guidance in the military is mandatory. And in that particular case, Captain Bence violated the guidance. And again, I'm not trying to throw dirt on him or anything. I think he's a very nice man and a good officer. But he did violate the guidance. That behooved him to go back and break the tie.
He violated the guidance by doing what?
By, in fact, giving her promote recommendation lower than her trade, than what was required for her trade average.
The the constraints on the number of people in a particular group that can be rated EP or MP is a limitation that he had to observe.
That's right. He did not. He observed that one, but there's also provisions in that instruction that says for a certain trade average, you get a certain promotional recommendation.
Okay.
He didn't
do that one. And if you look solely at that and you get a number that's in excess of the number of permissible EP and MP ratings, then what do you do?
Then you go back, as I said earlier, and do a trait-by-trait comparison and rework the traits. That's the only way you can do it.
So first that was the way to break the tie. Now you're saying it's a way to satisfy the curve that's been imposed.
And effectively that's what it does, is it breaks the tie and satisfies the curve. I mean, that's what you have to do, Judge. Otherwise, you're in the situation of being unfair to somebody. And that's what happened in this particular case. And
I understood that the basis of your argument was that with the trait calculation, the treatment of the must promote and so forth, the final decision was arbitrary. But now you're going back to say the whole trait calculation was done wrong or ought to have been redone. So, I mean, that seems a radical switch.
Actually, Judge Williams, I was just trying to answer Judge Ginsburg on how you would do it.
But his question followed from your presentation about the relationship between the two parts of the decision.
Yes, sir, I understand that. But I was just trying to illuminate, based on my experience, how you break those kind of ties or how you solve those kind of problems.
Would it have been permissible to break a tie like that by saying, well, considering the instruction of looking to the value of an officer in the next grade to the Navy, in the next grade up, I've decided for undisclosed reasons that A would be a more valuable asset than B?
Sure, you could have done that. Or on the other side, if you wanted to take care of both of them, you could have put a stronger item, a bullet in the fitness report.
So this process is really suffused with discretion.
Yes, sir. And that's part of the problem. And, you know, the Navy's been trying to resolve that. And I think we've gone through about five or six different systems.
It's a problem with that affects your opening suggestion that the board's entitled to less deference than military combat decisions.
Definitely.
But I realize that our circuit law is to the contrary.
Yes, sir, I understand. But, you know, your circuit law, I don't think really breaks it down from between administrative and operational tactical.
Well,
it's military type decisions.
In the Price case, anytime we're reviewing one of the board's decisions, we're looking at an administrative.
Sir, I understand the
point. And we've said time and again, starting in Christ, that we give great deference. More, even in applying the arbitrary and capricious standard, we apply it with greater deference than we would to a civilian agency.
I do understand that. But, you know, the Board for Correction of Naval Records has no special military expertise. They could be accountants, they could be logisticians, they could be attorneys.
Case law.
Understand.
This panel.
But even under that standard, let's take a look at what we have here. If you look at 10 U.S.C. 1552, why was it originally adopted? It was adopted so that Congress wouldn't have to pass private bills to correct issues. They're equitable powers. The court decisions consistently say that the BCNR should apply equitable standards. And here what we have, and you know, for all the arguments that you've made, and they're certainly good arguments there, Judge Ginsburg, we still have a situation where the captain did not recognize something. We can't 100% say that if he had to do it over again, he would have broken the tie a different way. But what we can say is that the BCNR's powers and duties are to apply equitable issues. And I don't think we have to meet a reasonable doubt standard for them to do that. I think even under the...
Isn't the trouble with equitable standards that as long as the chancellor's foot, they vary enormously from decider to decider. And
well, that's true.
So we would have to say that we find here basically something like an abuse of discretion.
In the case of the board's action, an abuse of discretion, arbitrary and capricious. Yes, sir, I think so.
All right, so let's talk about that for a moment. That's your third argument.
Yes, Your Honor.
Where the decision is that for substantially the reasons stated in the advisory opinions, we're denying any relief.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I thought you were finished.
What I'm trying to understand is what was the reasoning that the board applied in its December 22nd decision letter, given that there are problematic statements in the advisory opinions?
Basically, as I understand their decision, they incorporated and adopted the advisory opinions.
No, I don't think you heard my question then. That was a friendly question. Just so you're clear, that's your third argument.
Yes, Your Honor.
The board says in its decision letter, for substantially the reasons in the advisory opinions.
Yes, sir. Yes, Your Honor.
Those opinions you point out don't deal with some of her evidence.
That's correct.
They develop standards that she didn't have to meet.
That is correct.
And they don't acknowledge these errors. Now, it doesn't mean they would have reached a different decision necessarily, but how is this court to tell, given the problematic aspects of the advisory opinions, what the board was deciding?
And therein you can't. And that's why you have to look at trying to decide whether under the substantial evidence standard there was enough evidence as reflected for them to come to the decision.
We have these cases that say, an agency may not tell us everything we need to know, but we can figure out the path that the agency was following.
Yes, ma'am.
So with this decision letter of December 22nd, 2009, I'm trying to find the path. I understand the result, the ultimate conclusion, that they denied her relief.
Judge Rogers, I don't think there is a path, and that seems to be a more common problem than not with the Board for Corrections. They don't really come out and list their path or their reasoning. They tend to rubber stamp the advisory opinions. That's one of the reasons why we're responding to them as advisor, or why we brought up the arbitrary and capricious argument.
I'm anticipating the response will be, the decision letter shows that the board asked for all these different views in an abundance of procedural regularity, if I can put it that way.
It also gives the
fact, and the fact that there may be some problematic statements is not enough to find that the board's decision was arbitrary and capricious. And what is your best response to that argument?
My best response is, again, you have to go back to what the purpose of the board is, was to correct injustice and do and provide equitable relief. What seems to be happening here is that they are becoming over-technical, over-esoteric, and imposing legal standards and sometimes enhanced legal standards to justify their opinion, as well as providing only, the rubber stamp of the advisory opinions. And here's the problem. We're going back to the very people, the very organization that we're saying has committed an error, and we're saying, okay, what do you think about this? And, of course, they come back and say, we're right.
Well, of course, but these were not the people involved directly in the decisions.
There is still a tendency within the government, especially
within
the military circle of wagons.
But we have recognized that you can't taint the whole agency because of one bad apple.
I understand that also, Your Honor. Again, I can only say it's becoming a common problem. The problem with unbridled discretion is it's like unbridled power. Sometimes it leads to the unbridled abuse of discretion.
I don't think we've been talking about unbridled discretion here. But the point is, or at least the argument's being made by the Navy, that it does have some guidelines, but they're not mandatory. They give a lot of discretion to the decision maker. And absent something that's really untoward, this court shouldn't even address it.
The problem that you have, Your Honor, is they didn't follow the guidance. And now guidance, according to the appellees, is not mandatory, it's discretionary. And basically what happens is, as long as somebody can spin a reason, then it becomes acceptable, at least in the eyes of the correction boards. And Your Honor, the other problem, and I'm way over my time, I apologize, but that these correction boards, it's not a situation of a give and take as we have here. It's done, they meet in private. Hearings are seldom, if ever, granted. There is no discovery rights. Now, we have somewhat corrected that by doing our own investigation, etc. But still, we cannot come up, address the board, answer their questions. Instead, they can basically sit there and come up with whatever decision they want to come up with, and then give an excessive deference.
But in this case, in any event, you did submit statements.
We did.
And you had a right to appeal.
We did.
And you exercised that right.
Yes, Your Honor. Right. Judge, I realize...
Mr. Wells, let me ask you this.
Yes, sir.
I understood you just to be saying a moment ago that the board's reliance on the advisory opinions was somehow to be discounted because they come from an interested party. But I realize this is a paper proceeding, but it is an adversarial proceeding.
It is.
And if we were to decide this case in your favor on the basis of your briefs and just said the decision is remanded for the reasons given in the petitioner's brief, you think we would be derelict?
Yes, sir. And one of the things
is...
Yes,
we would be derelict.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, okay, good.
But you said this is an adversarial proceeding at the board, and you're right. But the point is it should not be. And that was what the entire plan of Congress in adopting the correction boards was. It was to sit there to review with an eye in favor of the petitioner to see if there was injustice. And
so they hear from the petitioner, you filed your case.
Yes.
And then they sought another perspective from the legal counsel and so on.
Yes.
And
then I respond.
And indeed, you relied in part on comments made for this proceeding by Captain Kirkpatrick, who was her advocate.
Yes, sir. That's correct.
I mean, I don't understand why there's any objection to advocacy on all sides.
It's just between advocacy and adversary, Your Honor. I would suspect that the BCNR, as an arm of the Secretary of the Navy, and its members are appointed by the Secretary of the Navy, have gotten to the point where they feel that they also must advocate for the Secretary of the Navy.
All right. So let me understand your response to Judge Ginsburg's question. You said it was an adversarial proceeding.
Yes, sir. Yes, ma'am, I believe it was.
What was?
It's an adversarial proceeding.
No, what proceeding was adversarial? I thought you said the correction board's proceedings are not adversarial.
The correction board proceedings are designed not to be adversarial.
All
they
right,
have
so
become adversarial. That's the point I'm trying to make, Judge.
Well, I don't understand that at all.
Originally.
The reason I'm saying it that way is because what I hear you saying is that there's inherent bias in the process.
Yes, ma'am.
So that even if a complaining member of the service has reasons, they will never be acknowledged because of this agency bias.
I think the proper term would be
so. So is that what you mean by adversarial?
No, I think that's what I mean by bias. Adversarial, my belief is that the correction boards have become, rather than an independent agency to review potential errors, they have become an arm of the service to justify potential errors. And Your Honor, I don't make that statement lightly.
That's a pretty strong
I understand.
Indictment.
I served 22 years in the Navy. I love the Navy. But, you know, I've been doing this for about 15 years also, military type law. And, you know, I don't want to go outside the record and give you examples. I can tell you that that is my opinion based on my observation.
All right. So why don't we hear from...
Yes, Your Honor, and I do apologize for going over time.
No, we were asking your questions.
I didn't address the other issue of the gender discrimination. If I could do that for a few moments afterwards,
yes,
I appreciate it.
Yes, we'll give you a couple of minutes. All right, counsel for appellees.
May it please the court.
Good morning.
Alexander Shoaibi for appellees. The district court was correct that the board's decision met the unusually deferential standard of review that's applicable specifically in cases involving military personnel decisions. As this court has stated, perhaps only the most egregious decisions may be prevented under such a deferential standard of review.
The most egregious decisions may what?
Maybe.
You said prevented.
I believe that the word was prevented.
Yes. And that's not been the thrust of our questions here.
Well.
They're raising a due process, a gender discrimination, and an arbitrary and capricious.
That's correct.
And as I read their brief, they are not saying this court should direct the Navy to give her this promotion. They're saying she's entitled to a fair procedure, that if you look at the word fellow in the context of two men and two women, it takes on a gender connotation. And then third, that the board's December decision was arbitrary and capricious.
I think that's
correct. So they're not even asking this court to prevent the Navy from doing something. Well, just want to be clear about that.
That can be deferential. That is clear, Your Honor, but the fact about that particular quote from this court is that it does show how deferential the standard is, in fact, that only the most egregious decisions should be prevented or should be changed. So I'm not specifically talking about...
And what was the context of that, that we're not supposed to tell the military how to conduct its battles? I mean, you know, I think we have to look at this in context. That's all I'm getting at. And you have not argued, for example, that the arguments she presents are simply beyond our ability to consider.
No.
All right.
No. But I am arguing, I did argue in the brief, and I'm arguing here, that it is an arbitrary and capricious standard, and it is an extremely deferential one. And based on the record in this case, and as the district court correctly found, both of the board's decisions, the 2000 and the 2009, applying to the three FITREPs at issue, provided reasons the court can measure for their decision. Specifically, in the first decision, they pointed out, they looked at the fact that there was an increased number of officers, that the rating official conceded that he had made a mistake with the increased number of officers, and they determined that that it made no difference with regard to the ultimate promotion. And this is an important point, Your Honor, because I want to make this clear. And it goes somewhat to the later due process argument. These are promotion recommendations. These are not decisions on promotions. These are simply recommendations. But they found that that would not have made a difference. And again, they also addressed the argument by appellant that ONI Instruction 1610.2 is guidance. It is not a direction that anything should happen. It simply states that these are ranges, and specifically says that officers can be outside of those ranges. So it is only guidance. And then with regard to the 2009 board decision, as the court already said, the decision took into account the advisory opinions. It did not say we adopted them.
It said substantially for the reasons stated. And, you know, this court has had experience with that exact phrase, and we've abandoned it. Because the court, we used to say, we affirm substantially for the reasons stated by the district court. And nobody knew what reasons we had agreed with, what reasons we qualified, and what reasons we rejected. So that's where I am in looking at the final decision. substantially for the reasons stated in the advisory opinions.
The exact language was substantially concurred. By saying substantially, I think they are saying that they didn't necessarily concur with everything in the three advisory opinions. What they did was they took advantage of three advisory opinions to come to their conclusion. And as they state,
which is
clearly,
that she would get no relief. I understand the conclusion, but your brief says that they treated this as an entirely new petition, all right, leading to this December 2009 decision.
Right.
So when you look at these advisory opinions, EOE simply says, well, she hasn't shown a pattern of discrimination. And she no response to her claim that there was a departure from the prior pattern. All right? The personnel command doesn't even acknowledge the error in Captain Bence's statement. The naval intelligence says, well, it's a local guard guide, but its approach is somewhat inconsistent with the approach taken by the Office of Legal Counsel, which has no explanation of the evidence she offered. I'm not saying you can't proceed this way, but all I'm saying is if it's a new proceeding, as your brief argues, and all we have from the board is substantially for the reasons stated in the advisory opinions, and you look at those advisory opinions, and they're not dealing with some of the claims she's making, then what is the court to do? Just say, well, we defer.
Well, I think that that they do deal with most of the claims that she's making. And I think that all the board has done is simply taken advantage of the opportunity to have additional analysis and viewpoints and took those into consideration. And again, I think that they, by saying they substantially concur, they're showing that they did, in fact, look at all these various factors.
So, hypothetically, a petitioner raises 10 arguments and offers evidence to support those 10 arguments. It's a hypothetical. And the board gets three advisory opinions, and they deal with six of the arguments and six of the evidence. Defer?
Your Honor, I would say that under the standard, I would have to obviously know about the specifics of the case and the facts. But under the hypothetical, I would say that under the unusually deferential standard, the arbitrary
and capricious. So your answer is yes.
My answer would be in that circumstance, very likely yes.
So the whole purpose of having these boards here to exercise their own discretion as to what should happen really is a waste of anybody's time, because you can raise 10 issues. If they only deal with six, the court's hands are tied. That's your position?
Well, Your Honor, my position again would be that it would depend on the specifics of the case.
Of course, my hypothetical.
And I'm not going to make a blanket statement that 6 out of 10 is good enough.
That's all you needed to say. All right, now, why, as to the things the advisory opinions don't address, all right, we say these are so minuscule and insignificant that there was no need for the board to look at these claims? So the fact that they only looked at the ones they did is sufficient.
Well, I don't think, first of all, that by saying that they substantially concurred with and by, in fact, referencing advisory opinions, they're saying that that's all we considered. They're saying that that is something that they asked for and they considered that along with the entire record. I believe that they have, the opinions provide the reasoned approach that is important here, and they do address the primary arguments, the fact that the 16.10.2 is a guideline. The issue regarding gender, the issue regarding the use of the term fellow.
Well, on the gender, they don't address her claim. The EEO says she didn't show a pattern of discrimination, but that's not her claim.
Well, it is They're three opinions, Your Honor. I mean, that particular opinion talked about the pattern.
Well, you were saying that they addressed her gender. That was the only one I saw that addressed her gender claim.
Well, it does. Military Personnel Command decision, Appendix 120 through 123, talks on page 122 about the term fellow officer. Military parlance, gender neutral, refers to both female and male officers.
I understand the district court looks at dictionary definitions and ignores context, but obviously a word gains its meaning from context.
It certainly does, Your Honor.
All right, so if there are two males and there are two females, and the deciding official says, I'm going to favor the fellows, does any reasonable female think that they are included in that?
Well,
summary judgment, plaintiff is entitled to all reasonable inferences.
Your Honor, the term, it did not say I'm going to favor the fellows. I think that might be a different circumstance, although I'm not saying that it necessarily would, but it might be. Here it was fellow officer, and fellow officer, I believe, it would be like me talking about the nice lady that I met this morning as a fellow furloughed government employee.
Yes, context is everything.
Context is everything.
And Your Honor, we're talking about a recommendation for promotion. We're not talking about a social comment.
That's correct, and I think that
my only point is the advisory opinions don't deal with it. I'm not saying necessarily it would come the same way, but don't they have to address her argument?
Well, again, I believe they did. I mean, I think when they're talking about they do address the use of the term fellow. The fact that in military parlance it's gender neutral. I mean, they're talking about military. And, Your Honor, that's an important point here. These are the experts. This is the military. They know what somebody means when they say fellow officer.
Context. I mean, you can't look at a word in isolation.
I don't think they are. I think these are the experts that are saying when somebody says fellow officer in the military, they don't mean necessarily a man. And I have to point this out, Your Honor, because I think this is extremely important. Appendix 208. Yep. In Commander Roberts' statement to the record, if you look at her statement, she says, at my debrief, the reporting senior said that another male commander was coming up for his third look by the FY06 Commander C-Screen Selection Board, administrative. And as a team player, I agree that a fellow officer should get his best opportunity. This is Commander Roberts. Now, are we to believe that she would only say a fellow officer, a fellow male officer? No, she means a fellow officer.
If it was
a fellow...
But again, we're talking context. That's her statement. We're talking about the official's statement in the context in which it is made.
I understand.
That's all I'm getting at.
I do understand that context is important, but you can't say that every time somebody says fellow and is referring to a man, they
not
must have meant...
Not saying that. Not even suggesting that. But all I'm saying is... The analysis looks at the dictionary and says end of analysis. And so did the district court, frankly. Yeah.
The analysis made by military experts that know how people use the term in the military better than the district court does.
Actually, the phrase used in that page 122 and that advisory opinion is specifically in military parlance.
Exactly right. It's military parlance.
On the pattern question.
I'm sorry, on what question, Your Honor?
The pattern
yes.
question. Mm-hmm. I don't know that I have a page reference at hand, but as I read that, it was not saying, maybe it's not saying that the pattern of discrimination was required, which would be just a legal error, but rather that she had not, in suggesting that that gender was a motivating factor in Benz's decision, that if there had been a pattern, that would have been probative. But in fact, he had twice before recommended her for early promotion.
I believe, Your Honor, that they were talking about Rensky's decision in 2009. Yeah, I think that's right. And I think that's correct. It was simply looking at other evidence that this was not based on gender. As Your Honor said, they were looking at the context. And the context was, this is not an officer who is known for doing this. This is an officer who the year before gave her, not a must promote, he gave her an early promote.
Right.
This is page 83, actually. No. Yes, that's my understanding, that it was not imposing a requirement on her to show a pattern, but rather saying, just looking at context, it's not as if this was a fellow whose decisions are suspect.
I think that's correct.
Under the ground of this, even if this one doesn't seem blatant, if there's a pattern, we're going to, that would be very telling.
I think that's exactly what they were doing, Your Honor.
And yet, she doesn't have any burden to show a pattern. And they never deal with the argument she's making, is all I'm getting. I understand you can read these things various ways, but we're on summary judgment, all right? And I'm just taking the words that they say. That's all I'm asking, all right? And what I didn't see in the December 2009 decision was some, as you say, overarching statement, basically re-endorsing what it had said in the earlier decision.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. You did not see an overarching statement endorsing
what? Well, you're saying that the board says, you know, substantially for the reasons in the advisory opinion and considering everything else in the evidence in our prior decisions, and there's nothing here that's been presented to us that would make us change our view. Because they said this was a new petition.
I think that's correct. And they took a new petition, and they asked for the advice of three separate advisory boards, and they looked at it and substantially concurred with it. I mean, I think they, quite frankly, did much more than they were required to do.
Mm-hmm. I think in some of our prior cases, we've actually looked ourselves at the contents of advisory opinions and taken those as where the board did not even identify them specifically.
I think that's correct.
So that's where the board's decision. Perhaps they went on summary judgment. I'll have to recheck that.
Going quickly to the other two main arguments they made, as far as the due process argument is concerned, the appellant received ample due process here. As I stated earlier, 16.10.1.10 is a guidance. It specifically says it's guidance. It doesn't result in a promotion. It results in a promotion recommendation. The Officer Roberts, Commander Roberts, got her fit reps. She didn't like them. She appealed them to the board. She got her decision. She certainly proceeded with ample due process here.
Counsel, before you conclude, it occurs to me that based on what Judge Rogers was saying, that she may have raised a question about whether the 2000 decision is part of the, or essentially incorporated into the 2009 decision. The 2009 decision is looking for what, new evidence?
I think the 2009 decision was looking at it as a new case. That's correct.
As a new case?
Yes.
But does that mean that they should deal with things that were dealt with in the 2000 decision? Or only new evidence suggesting an error in the 2000 decision? If there is some.
I would think that it would be fine for them to look at the 2000 decision as well. I mean, they're allowed to consider.
My understanding was that the 2000 decision, it wasn't preclusive because new evidence would be considered, but that absent new evidence sufficient to overcome inertia, as it were, the 2000 decision was dispositive on the points that it covered.
I think that's correct, Your Honor. And I think that with this new, she had the opportunity to present new information in front of the 2009 board. I think that's correct.
So is your reading of the board's 2009 opinion that it was treating her challenges to the 1997 reports as already decided and done with?
No, I don't think that's correct, Your Honor. I think they were looking. I believe she made her appeal to the 2000 board of the 97 FITREPs. She again made that same appeal to the 2009 board of the 97 FITREPs and the 2005 FITREPs. So I think that they were looking at those anew.
Looking at 1977 anew?
97 anew, yes.
And we know that because?
Because in their report, they state that they state in the very beginning.
What page are you
on? I'm looking at appendix page 42.
Document material considered by the board consisted of your application together with all material submitted in support thereof, the board's file on your prior case, etc.
Yes, Your Honor.
Anything further, counsel?
Well, simply with regard to the final argument, the gender discrimination argument. I think that the appellant did not show evidence of gender discrimination sufficient to overturn the board's decision. Again, there was lengthy analysis by the board in 2009 with regard to the fellow, the use of the fellow term. As I pointed out earlier, her own statement bespeaks her view that fellow is gender neutral. And that it can be used in military parlance, typically. In addition, there was no evidence whatsoever in the record that the males who allegedly promoted over her were more qualified than her. As a matter of fact, she refers to
Don't you mean it the other way around?
Pardon? There's no evidence that they were more qualified than her. That she was more qualified than them. I'm sorry, but the fact the only evidence in there is that they were the same, and when you look at
but she had combat experience, and the response was, well, that was in an earlier reporting period, I found to be non-responsive.
It was a factual correction, I guess, but the fact is that she was. She can't show gender discrimination if she can't show that she was better qualified than these individuals. And Cavillo says in Lord's report that at best they were the same. Based on that, they haven't met their burden with regard to gender discrimination as well. And for these reasons, we would ask that the district court's decision be affirmed.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel for appellant.
Your Honor, I apologize if I look a little unsteady up here. I've had foot surgery and it's was running into a bit of a balance problem there. Very briefly, in response to issue raised by Judge Ginsburg, Kevin Bent's letters at Appendix 5152 were submitted after the earlier BCNR decision, and 2009 was the first time they had seen them, so there was some new evidence there.
The OLC opinion suggests that in their opening presentation in the advisory opinion, that new evidence is the issue, whether there's sufficient new evidence to reopen or overcome the 2000s.
That was in the advisory opinion, and again, the new evidence standard is not defined anywhere in the statute or the it is somewhat in the CFR. We would contend that we met the standard as defined in the CFRs. In regards to the issue with the gender discrimination, and we can define fellow any way you want it. Perhaps the way I've defined it during my 22 years active duty was different than the gentleman who, on page 83, wrote his opinion. But, I don't know for all the way the government calls him an expert, but I have no idea whether this gentleman, Gordon E. Bradshaw, is an expert or not. I don't even know if he's military.
Did you think your client's use of the term fellow officer meant exclusively male officers?
No, Your Honor. I've seen the women tend to use it more than the men. When the men use it, they mean men. When the women use it, they mean meeting everybody. That's just kind of my observations. But I can tell you this.
You have only two data points, unfortunately.
Yes. I can tell you this. Nobody is going to stand up there and say, I'm discriminating against you because you're female, but there were 26,000 complaints of discrimination or harassment in the Department of Defense last year, 10,000 of which were in the United States Navy. So it is alive and well there. That's why you've seen so much on Congress under Gillibrand's bill, which effectively strips convening authorities of all powers. But, you know, if you look at the fellows and look at the issue of the groups, we had a group of three fellows on one, and that was the CO and the two males, and a group of two females that were below the 50% part. And they were a different kind of fellows. They weren't in the fellowship group on the three. They weren't in with the CO. Okay, and that's an established fact. As Judge Rogers pointed out, she was the only one that went to the green zone. And when we're talking about an intelligence officer of how you apply raw intelligence into combat operations and how you provide information so that the people that are in charge of moving troops around can make good decisions, that combat experience, as well as her seaborne experience, during the first war and the insertion of troops into Afghanistan is critical. And those fitness reports were stellar. So, you know, if you're looking at, and she has to show a substantial motivating factor, she has to show some inference on the summary judgment standard. If you look at all this, you know, I think that there is a definite question as to who should have been given the early promote, who was higher. And I think that the inference on a summary judgment standard would have to go to Commander Roberts.
Mr. Wells, you said that her rating was, that there were two males that were rated above her.
That's correct.
And one female rated below her?
One female below her, yes, sir.
Is this the rating in which her rating was 4.67?
Judge, I'd have to look it up to be certain. I think.
So I think the government brought out that was actually below the average of 4.75 for the group.
Well, that should tell you how high he jumped the other guys.
Well, yeah, all of these.
I mean, 500 is the max.
The ratings have either suffered the great inflation that the schools have encountered, or this was a small group of superlative officers.
Great inflation is not unknown in fitness reports writings, Your Honor. In fact,
all right. Anything further? Because I think it's clear this court is not going to tell.
If I could just make one correction, is the government said that the O&I instruction specifically said this was voluntary. That's not the case. I think if you look at it, you'll see it used the word will follow this, and will has been defined the same as shall. Your Honors, I thank you so much. I apologize for going over time. I appreciate you giving me some extra one. And we would ask that you find in favor of the appellant. And thank you very much.
Thank you. We will take the case under advisement.